From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Where did Batista live, the former dictator?
He lived in the presidential palace in the inner city.
But Castro doesn't live there.
No, he lives in the outskirts of the city. After the revolution, those symbols of the previous regime were abandoned. I mean, the presidential palace is now a museum, and the Capitol building is now the Ministry of Science, Technology, and Environment.
We take a tour of Havana leading up to the Pope's visit, and more arrests and beatings in Nigeria. We'll speak with family members close to the story. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's coalition government was plunged into crisis yesterday when David Levy, the former foreign minister, announced his resignation in protest against the government's economic and so-called peace policies. Levy also plans to withdraw his five-member Gesher faction from Benjamin Netanyahu's 66-member governing right-wing coalition, leaving the prime minister's multi-party government with a thin majority. Last week, Levy delayed approval of the government's 1998 budget, demanding additional allocations for welfare spending. Announcing his resignation, Levy said he did not trust last-minute government promises to meet his demands. He also lashed out at the government's foot-dragging over implementation of peace accords with the Palestinians. Zapatista rebels in Mexico are accusing the government of harassing rebel supporters in an effort to obscure its role in the recent massacre of 45 peasants. According to the Zapatistas, the military has stepped up weapons searches and other activities in the southern state of Chiapas to, quote, cover up its responsibility in the Actial massacre. Actial is a village in Chiapas. The government of President Ernesto Zedillo has repeatedly denied any link to the December 22nd killings and has arrested 46 people, suspected members of a paramilitary death squad linked to the governing Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI. The rebels released their statement late Saturday, hours after Zedillo replaced his hardline interior secretary with Francisco Labastida Ochoa, a politician who declared he would immediately seek a decisive peace in Chiapas. He also said he'd seize weapons on all sides of the conflict. After the Actial slaughter, most of whose victims were women and children, Zedillo sent more than 5,000 troops into Chiapas, adding to at least 35,000 already scattered throughout the state's mountains and canyons. Longtime Kenyan leader Daniel Arap Moi took the presidential oath today, pledging to rid his government of the costly corruption that has characterized his previous four terms. Critics blame Moi for the rampant corruption. Moi remains under pressure at home and abroad. 60% of Kenyans voted for one of his 13 challengers, and world leaders have put him on notice to reform his government. Last week's election, which ran for an unprecedented second day, was marred by charges of rigging and 8 deaths in political violence. An Ethiopian convicted of murder in Arizona has died after a hunger strike that he called in protest of his prison diet, this according to Arizona state officials. The inmate, Tashomi Abate, had staged several hunger strikes during the year in protest of the prison system's refusal to feed him what he called an Ethiopian Orthodox diet. Abate was hospitalized on September 3rd under a court order. He agreed to take small amounts of food and liquids. But in the last month, prison officials said Abate had ripped out his feeding tubes and his weight had fallen to 75 pounds from 149. Abate, who was an illegal immigrant, had been serving a 20-year sentence for second-degree murder at the state prison in Florence, about 50 miles south of Phoenix, before being hospitalized. Opening arguments in the Unabomber trial are scheduled to begin today with a defense strategy weakened by Theodore Kaczynski's refusal to undergo psychiatric tests to build a mental defect case. His waging of an 18-year bombing spree doesn't appear in dispute. Although mad cow disease has never been documented in the United States, Oprah Winfrey says she had every right to speculate on her show about the possibility of an outbreak here. Texas cattlemen disagree, and tomorrow jury selection begins in a trial to determine whether Oprah Winfrey defamed an entire industry when the disease was made fodder for her show. Cattlemen claim they lost millions of dollars because of the show. During an Oprah Winfrey show broadcast in April 1996, a guest said that feeding ground-up animal parts to cattle, which was being done at the time, could spread the disease to humans in the United States. To applause from the studio audience, Winfrey exclaimed, "It's just stopped me from eating another burger." Cattle prices began to fall the day of the show and fell for 2 weeks before rising again. In June, the U.S. banned the feeding of most animal parts to cattle, and in December, imports of cattle and sheep from Europe were banned. But slaughtered animal parts can still be fed to pigs, chicken, fish, pets, and other animals in the United States, and those animals in turn can be processed into feed for cows. The Terry Nichols jury is to hear closing arguments and may begin deliberations today in the penalty phase of the second Oklahoma City bombing trial. The defense rested Friday after Nichols' family and friends pleaded for his life to be spared. And Algeria's interior minister insisted media reports that 412 people were massacred in western villages last week were false. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nigerian security forces this weekend raided several Ogoni villages in the southeastern part of the oil-rich West African country and arrested dozens of independence activists in a bid to stop annual Ogoni Day observances. Activists are demanding autonomy for the 500,000 Ogoni people in Nigeria, as well as compensation from oil giant Royal Dutch Shell for the environmental devastation caused to Ogoni land. The plight of the Ogoni burst onto the international scene in 1995 when Ogoni activist and internationally renowned author Ken Saro-Wiwa was executed along with eight others by the Nigerian military regime of General Sani Abacha. Shell Oil, which pumps around half of Nigeria's 2 million barrels per day of crude, allegedly encouraged the Abacha dictatorship to crack down on Ogoni activists. We're joined right now by Ken Saro-Wiwa, his brother, Owens Wiwa, a member of the steering committee of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. Dr. Wiwa joins us from Baltimore, Maryland. We're also joined by Dr. Leda Mete, the acting director of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. He joins us from London, England. And we understand, Leda Mete, that you've just learned that your younger brother was arrested in Ogoni land yesterday.
Thanks very much. Let me just say, the reports that we've just confirmed from Ogoni is that not only my younger brother, Batum, but about 45 others have been detained. Batum is said to be in very critical condition, that unless he receives urgent medical attention, his fate is very, very unclear from the torture he received. There's some other person, Tombari, who was tied to an electric pole and thoroughly beaten. We understand that also he's in an unconscious state. A woman was shot, and the soldiers shot into a crowd in Bori, and a woman fell down. We don't know whether he's living or dead, and they said they took her body away. The Assemblies of God Church in Bori, soldiers fired guns to disperse the worshippers yesterday. And three villages have been raided, people thrown into the bush, and a state of siege is ongoing in Ogoni today.
Dr. Owens Wiwa, can you tell us about the significance of Ogoni Day?
Ogoni Day, January 4th, has been marked every year in Ogoni since 1993, and it's a symbol of the courage and commitment of the Ogoni people to confront nonviolently the alliance of Shell Oil and the Nigerian military dictatorship who has been persecuting people. And there has always been soldiers posted to Ogoni prior to those days, but the Ogoni people have always been committed in coming out peacefully to remember the day and also to do the annual festivities, the end-of-year festivities we usually do for our Yam Festival. It is very important to us culturally to remember our trees and our rivers. So that is the significance of the day. And the repression of the Abacha regime on the Ogoni people is very significant, because this is a government that says they are going towards democracy, yet they are stopping every gathering of people, every expression of people's wish in a peaceful way. And we can hear about, you know, the torture of people that is continuing. And this is something that must be stopped.
You know, it's interesting that this is taking place while here in the United States, the U.S. government is reassessing its Nigeria policy. Can you explain, since you are here, Dr. Wiwa, in the United States, what exactly that assessment is all about? I understand it is to improve relations with the Nigerian regime, to engage in something we know from the old U.S. relationship with South Africa, to engage in constructive engagement.
Yes, I've heard about, you know, the policy changes that they are trying to make. We, on the other hand, are trying to impress on the administration that constructive engagement will not work with Abacha. Anything that permits him to have audience with the international community, anything that permits him to continue to use the oil, the money from the oil, to buy weapons, will encourage the persecution of people. It might even lead to genocide of some certain people in Nigeria, and we are seeing it happening gradually. The benchmarks are there. The example of Rwanda, the gradual human rights abuses that went on in Rwanda before the genocide, is exactly what is happening in Nigeria, specifically targeted at definite ethnic groups. Like you have the Ogonis, the Yorubas that have been targeted now. At a time, they will bring all the weapons that they've bought and use it on the people indiscriminately. And we want to stop that. That is the purpose of our cry to the world, to help us. We've told them about the ways they can stop. They can stop Abacha completing the dehumanization of people.
We're talking to Dr. Owens. We were actually at the airport in Baltimore, a member of the steering committee of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, known as MOSAP. And Owens Wiwa is the brother of Ken Sarawiwa, who was executed several years ago with 8 minority rights activists who were all Ogoni activists. And in fact, I met Leda Mete a few years ago here in the United States when he came into the studio with Ken Sarawiwa. Leda Mete joining us from London, England, acting director of MOSAP. Now, Leda Mete, with your youngest brother now in jail, what are you calling for and why was he targeted?
Oh, well, the attacks by these forces yesterday and even the run-up to the Ogoni Day on most of activists and on armed protesters and on innocent guests at the hotel have been particularly savage, even by the standards of the Abacha regime, I must say. I mean, what the message of these are supposed to do are intended not only for us but for other Democrats in Nigeria, that this regime is prepared to do everything to use the acts of terrorism to suppress our demands. We are asking people that, I mean, the international community, the United States government and others, that this is a clear sign that unless some positive action is taken to put pressure on this regime, the Ogoni people will be extinct. We also ask other people, including ordinary people, to put pressure on their respective representatives to support the bill on Nigeria by Senator Payne, and which has been introduced into Congress.
That's New Jersey Congress member.
Yes. And I also feel also that we should be able to write letters to other members of Congress and to ask the State Department also to put pressure on the regime. They should be able to call the Nigerian ambassador to express serious concern about these developments and to seek that these people are released, particularly those who have been detained, including and the military siege that is ongoing to be lifted, and the military troops of occupation that continue to visit these doses of violence on our people.
Dr. Owens, we were the arrests this weekend on the eve of Ogoni Day come after some major events of the last few weeks. Can you talk about who else is in prison now? These are not Ogoni activists, but Nigerian activists, dissidents, journalists, and the significance of the man who died just a few weeks ago.
Well, yeah, it was death shocked many of us because he belonged to the military elite, and we thought they would take special care of him when he was sick.
Can you say his name again?
General Yaradua.
General Yaradua.
Yes. The mere fact that he was not taken care of, you know, is an indication of the extent to which Abacha would go to eliminate his opponents. There are quite a lot of other notable Nigerians, like General Obasanjo, who was one is the president of the country. You have Chief Moshood Abiola, who won a free and fair election, and the former leader of the Nigerian Medical Association, Beko Ransom Kuti, and the labor union leaders, student union leaders. The list goes on and on and on. It is quite a lot. The man is putting all those who has alternative views under lock and key, those that he cannot kill outright. This is a man that has to be stopped. As Ledu Mite has said, we want people to pay attention to the bill in the House of Representatives, the bill on sanctions on Nigeria. I will also seriously want people to reconsider buying oil from Shell. All pressures has to be put on the transnational corporations that is keeping Abacha in power. They are the pillar of his dictatorship. And unless we collectively, people all over the world collectively, listen to our concerns and act now, we are afraid that what happened to my brother and eight of our colleagues will happen to quite a larger number of people.
Let me ask you about, again, the U.S. policy, because my understanding with the reassessment of U.S. policy towards Nigeria, with very little said about the death of the general in custody of Sonny Abacha, this even as Madeleine Albright was going through Africa on the tour that she did recently, that the U.S. government is going to improve relations with the Nigerian regime leading up to the October so-called elections. What about these elections?
Well, our position on the transition program that Abacha has been doing and the position of most other Nigerians that we have been able to sample their opinions is that the transition program does not carry the people along. So in that sense, it is not acceptable to many people. It will not solve the problems in Nigeria. And we will urge many governments in the West not to accept the result of that transition program, especially. Now, about the U.S. policy on Nigeria, apart from the fact that they said they are going to go into constructive engagement with the military dictatorship, we've also had something about trying to build a civil society and helping the NGOs in Nigeria. That is welcome as a way of ensuring that people collectively march towards any democratic callings. But the other one of constructive engagement with Abacha is what we've had about before during the period of the South African regime. That did not work. The thing that removed that the apartheid system was the withdrawal of the companies and the boycott of companies who were doing business there. That is what is keeping this regime on. As long as the United States continue to buy the oil from Nigeria, as long as other countries continue to buy that oil, Abacha will have the money to buy the weapons of repression, to shoot Ogoni people, to torture people. That is the key.
I just wanted to give our listeners on Democracy Now! An update on a story that we did a while ago on Nigeria. Listeners may remember we had in our studio Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Moshood Abiola, who is the man who ran for president. As many believe, he was elected, but Sonny Abacha put him in jail. He's been there for years. Her mother is Kudirat Abiola, I should say, was, because she was gunned down on the streets of Lagos a few years ago as she organized for the release of her husband, Moshood Abiola. Well, Hafsat has been involved in the campaign to name this street in front of the Nigerian UN mission in New York after her mother, Kudirat Abiola. It passed the New York City Council. It was then held up by a judge, but ultimately it has been approved, and that street is being named Kudirat Abiola Corner, to the great upset of the Nigerian mission and the Nigerian government. Apparently, the former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, Walter Carrington, said that issue in his last month in Nigeria before he was, I think it's fair to say, pushed out by the Clinton administration because of a strong stance against Nigeria. That issue preoccupied the Nigerian regime. For some reason, they were very concerned about the naming of this street in New York after Kudirat Abiola. And now there's an effort in Washington to name the street of the Nigerian embassy. Is it after Ken Saro-Wiwa?
Yes.
And will that happen?
We're going on for it. The important thing is that this street is where the Nigerian mission in Washington is, and also New York, where the Nigerian mission is. Okay. We want the names of these two great Nigerians on their letterhead anytime they are writing, for them to remember what they've done to them always.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And also, if you would like to give a phone number where people can contact MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People.
Well, for the U.S., they can contact MOSOP at 773-643-5310. And they can also get us on the website at mosopcanada.org. That's mosopcanada.org.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank you both for joining us. Owens Wiwa, member of the steering committee, Lenda Mete, the acting director, both of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. And again, the phone number to reach in the United States, 773-643-5310, and the website, www.mosopcanada.org. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a tour of Havana, Cuba. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Something like 4,000 journalists and support workers from the United States are expected to head to Havana, Cuba later this month to cover the visit of Pope John Paul II. Just ahead of the journalistic mob, I got a chance to travel to Havana last week with Global Exchange, the human rights group based in San Francisco, California. And over these next few weeks in the run-up to the Pope's visit, we're going to play some of those conversations that I had in Cuba. Today we'll start by giving you a sense of place, a place that has been so cut off from the American public because of the U.S. blockade against Cuba, an embargo that has been in place since the Eisenhower administration in 1960, all the way through the Clinton administration, which has simply changed that embargo into a stranglehold through the Helms-Burton Act. We're going to begin with a tour from a Cuban architect, an architectural tour that really gives a social and political landscape of this historic city. It is the capital of Cuba. It is Havana. We're joined by Miguel Coyula, an architect with the Group for the Integral Development of the City of Havana. I spoke with him last week in front of a model of the city of Havana that he and many students had built. And this is what he had to say to me, and through me to you, all of the listeners of Democracy Now!, people throughout the United States and those throughout the world who are listening to Democracy Now! On the web, as he described his city.
So this, what you see here in the scale model of the city, is this a city that hasn't been touched in the 20th century, because in the first half of this century, Havana had a very fast development. But in the second half, I mean after the revolution, after 1959, the majority of the effort was put outside of the capital, not in the capital itself. And this is one of the reasons why you see a big disrepair around Havana. But Havana has some specific characteristics. One is that we have a city that hasn't been, as I said before, that hasn't been touched in this century, because we are by the end of the century. And the second is that there are you don't see the problems you see in other cities. For example, you don't see homelessness or abandoned children like you see in other Latin American cities. You will wonder why. The reason is that we have some laws, some legal procedures that don't allow, for example, eviction. Eviction is forbidden, so nobody can expel you from your house, even if you don't have time to pay your rent or the debt with the bank. But also, if you your house collapses, the government is mandatory for the government to give you a shelter. So that is very important. That it's true that you see a big disrepair, there is a big housing shortage, but you don't see homelessness or abandoned children like you see in other Latin American cities. The same pays for social problems such as drugs, violence, crime, for example, hold-ups or other negative factors you see in other cities. This is not the case of the city of Havana. We have a different problem. The problem where the biggest problems we're facing now is that our economy was open to the foreign capital. And with the opening to the foreign capital, there is a big challenge for the city of Havana, because the city could be disappeared by the massive investment of the foreign capital if we don't care about the values we created along the 20th century and before. So we have, for example, one case here. There was a joint venture. They built a hotel, and the hotel is there telling us that that mistake should not be repeated anymore.
And the joint venture is done by?
It's Cuban and Spanish. In this case, this is a hotel that was built, and the foreign investor was allowed to build the hotel that was transplanted from Europe to Havana. So if you go to that building, and you are supposed, if you come to Havana, that you want to enjoy the sea breeze, you want to enjoy the sun. This is a sunny island. But if you go to that building, the only chance you have is to watch the ocean behind a tinted glass, and the only air you can breathe is air conditioning. So that is a nonsense. And that even makes the Hotel Riviera that was built in 1957 to look better. It's more logical. So this is one of the cases we should not repeat anymore, because if we lose the city, if we lose this Havana, we will have another city, a city that can we see in another place.
Like
something like any other city in the world. For example, I invented a verb because we have that case in Varadero. Varadero Beach is the most famous beach in Cuba. It's 100 kilometers to the east of Havana.
What is its historical significance in the revolution? Does it have one, Varadero Beach?
Varadero was the resort of the bourgeoisie, the most wealthy families in Cuba. But now Varadero is the most important touristic point in the city because it's attracting, because of the previous fame, it's attracting many tourists, and many tourists are coming. But what we see now in Varadero is that Varadero has been Cancunized. I mean, I use a verb to illustrate that Varadero is if we continue that way, Varadero will be a copy of Cancun. So if you have here a copy of Cancun, you can go to Cancun. You don't have to come to Havana. So the best...
But that also has social implications. Having just come from Cancun, the only way that an American can... there's a couple of ways that Americans can't come directly to Havana. And that is, in Cancun, it's not only just massive hotels for foreign tourists, but basically indigenous people who lived there or around there are not allowed in part of the complex. And I'm getting a sense there's a little of that here as well.
So if you visit Varadero, you're not in Cuba. So the tourist that comes to Varadero is not seeing Cuba. They must go out of Varadero if they want to see the social reality of Cuba. If you want to spend a week laying on the sand and swimming and enjoying sea sports, come to Varadero. But if you want to come to Cuba, don't come to Varadero. That's the truth. So the same could happen in Havana. Maybe we could see the seawall, the Malecon, along the shoreline. We could see in the future an endless row of glass boxes, the same boxes you see in other cities, instead of this eclectic architecture you have in the whole city. Because Havana can be red, I mean, in terms of architecture. If you start walking at the bay where Havana was founded in 1519, and you start walking toward west, you can see the development of the city. It's something unique. Suppose you start walking. If you have a good pair of shoes and a good wheel, you can start walking and you can move toward west and you can see the development of the city.
Well, you start
century after century.
You start with the Spanish forts of the 16th century.
Yes, exactly. You can start seeing a fort built in 1557, and you can walk toward west and see the latest things done in the 1990, for example. So you can see everything. You can see Art Nouveau, Art Deco, the eclectic Rococo. All the stars are here. Not only in isolated buildings, in vast zones of the city, we have this architecture, and it's there. So not only Old Havana that was declared a World Heritage by UNESCO in 1982 deserves to be preserved.
Why did UNESCO declare this as one of the historic places in the world today?
Because Old Havana, I mean, the part of the city that was surrounded by walls to protect the city against the pirates and the corsairs, is the only former colonial city in the Americas that preserves its urban grid complete. So anything has been altered there. All the streets are the same, so the infrastructure is the same. And they have the biggest collection of landmarks, palaces, buildings, squares, that is preserved in Latin America. Other Latin American historical cores were disappeared because of the land speculation, something that didn't happen in Havana, And after that, the government is concentrating a big attention and giving Old Havana, giving the preservation of the Old Havana the biggest attention, the first priority.
I thought it was interesting what you said before, that with the revolution, the decision was to focus outside of Havana, which is part of why it has been so well preserved, unlike other cities. Why?
Well, the attention was focused out of Havana because a capital of a non-developed country is totally different from the rest of the country. If you visit Havana, you are not visiting Cuba. It always happens. If you visit the capital of a non-developed country, you're not visiting the country. You must go to the outside of the capital city. So Havana concentrated before the revolution 20% of the population, but 65% of the GDP, I mean the gross domestic product. And to give you a single example, there was in Cuba 6,000 medical doctors before the revolution. 50% was here in Havana. So the same happens with the hospitals, medical care, everything. 90% of the architects were living here in the city, and so on. So the accent was put out of the city in order to balance the capital with the rest of the country. The bad side of this is that Havana suffered a lack of attention for maintenance and the preservation of the buildings. But the good side is that Havana is not facing a phenomenon that is common in other Latin American countries. Just compare Lima in Peru and Havana, and both cities had in 1959 1 million inhabitants. Havana has now, in 1987, 2.2 million, but Lima has 9. So you don't know what is happening in those cities. The same is happening in Caracas, and the biggest phenomenon is Mexico City. Mexico City is a country. It's not anymore a city, but it is a country. And there are some neighborhoods in Mexico that people don't know what is happening inside. So everything is out of control. So that, because there is a rule that people from the countryside come to the capital city looking for better opportunities. This is not the case of Havana. The balance, the immigration balance, was very low before the crisis. What we call the special period was very low because people can find jobs in their countryside. They can find good medical care because there many hospitals were built in the rest of the country, aqueducts, infrastructure, electricity, good roads, good schools, education, everything that they wanted, they could find that out of the city. So that's why that uncontrolled immigration that you see in other Latin American cities is not happening here. In other Latin American capitals, you find that you have two cities. Let's take Caracas or let's take Rio de Janeiro. In Rio or in Caracas, you have one city and you just cross the street and you are visiting another city. So maybe one city is the first world, but you just cross the street and you are in the third world. So in Rio, for example, here in a given street, the city ends, and you cross the street and you enter the favelas, and you enter a new world. So the income there is 50 times lower than in the other side of the street. And of course, this big disbalance between social groups brings violence.
As a person just coming into Havana for the first time, when I came in from the airport to Jose Marti Airport, named for the revolutionary leader of Cuba, the one thing I noticed was very different from other developing countries is you have this teeming poverty, usually when you drive in from an airport and making your way into the city, along with U.S. corporate billboards. You know, I did not see billboards for Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, and that is really a difference between Havana and everywhere else. That, yes, of course, has to do with the politics of, yes, here and the embargo as well.
Is that true? The only thing, this is a place in that foreign investors are very happy that they can invest in a country in which they will not face the U.S. competition. So they're big businesses, you know, American businesses, for good or bad, are not allowed to come and to invest in Cuba.
How has that affected the architecture, actually, with you as an architect?
Well, one part of the city was influenced by the European architecture, but in the 50s, there was a big influence of the American architecture in our architecture. In the late 50s, there was a what we call a Cuban movement. So I think that there was a big number of young Cuban architects that in the late 50s and in the early 60s were demonstrating that there was a Cuban architecture.
What is that Cuban architecture?
Well, more related to our needs, more related to our weather conditions, to our psychology. Instead of making copies of things you see in the magazines, they started doing things related to our reality, rescuing some values or some elements from our colonial architecture, Cuban colonial architecture, and adding new things to that architecture. But in some cases, you see the same buildings you could see in the United States. But now, after many years, the architecture suffers from a lack of information. And that's, and on the other hand, that the accent was put on producing massively, that the massive production of housing especially reduce the opportunities to create special buildings. Now we are recovering that architecture again. Mm-hmm. So now with the boom of touristic industry, architects have the chance to design hotels using different architecture. But I still see, like I saw in Varadero, that we still have the influence from outside. And I think that it is because after many years of without any information, adequate information, because the import of architecture magazines was reduced and in some cases disappeared, there was no reference of what is going on outside. But lately I see that there is a recovery in our architects to do what the things we want to do, in our way, the Cuban way.
Can you, in a sentence or two, describe the architecture of Old Havana, that vision that we have of Old Havana, but if you can put it in concrete terms?
Well, Old Havana is a very pleasant place because it has narrow and irregular streets, and it has beautiful squares, and especially those squares. Each square in Old Havana has a different meaning. For example, the Square of Arms was a square for political means. I mean, political buildings were built around the Square of Arms. This is what we could say the political square. But the cathedral square concentrated the most wealthy families in the city, so there was a social square, where these families used to visit the square and to walk around and to see each other, to socialize after the mass every Sunday.
You also have the first statue of Jose Marti built in the city.
It is, but that statue is now in the Central Park. The Central Park of the city, that is the boundary between Old Havana and the inner city.
Why did people start leaving Old Havana in terms of history? Why did they reach out beyond the walled inner city?
It happened especially in the first half of the 19th century, when the city that was, as I said before, the limits of the city were determined by the wall that surrounded the city, because the wall that was built in the 17th century wasn't demolished until in the 19th century. So the demolition of the city took about 50 years, and the demolition ended in the second half of the 19th century. But in the first half of the century, especially in the 30s, 1830 more or less, there was an epidemic of cholera, and wealthy families, after that epidemic, took many lives. The wealthy families started moving out, and they moved to another locality known as El Cerro. They started living out in big villas, country villas, that with the time were urbanized again. But if you visit El Cerro, you will see a long collection of beautiful houses from that date.
Where did Batista live, the former dictator?
He lived in the presidential palace in the inner city.
But Castro doesn't live there.
No, he lives in the outskirts of the city. When, after the revolution, those symbols of the previous regime were abandoned. I mean, the presidential palace is now a museum, and the Capitol building is now the Ministry of Science, Technology, and Environment. Mm-hmm. And there is a museum, too, a Museum of Natural History. So the parliament has a new building, and the political center moved from the inner city to El Vedado, around the Square of the Revolution. So the former Palace of Justice is now the governmental palace.
The Square of the Revolution is looked down on by Che Guevara, right?
Yes. There is a permanent portrait of Che Guevara. This is a tradition, because dated from 1968, when there was the announcement of his death in Bolivia. There was a mass rally there in the facade of the Ministry of the Interior. They put a picture, the most famous picture of the Che Guevara. And after that, the picture remained. It was changed many times. I mean, many artists were invited to bring their vision of Che. And there was always a different vision of Che in the square. But now there is a metal structure immortalizing the image of Che Guevara.
An iron, massive sculpture against a white backdrop of the building with lights now.
With the lights now, that's it. It's like an outline of Che Guevara's face.
And we'll continue our tour with Miguel Coyula, an architect with the Group for the Integral Development of the City of Havana, when we return here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In just a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, just back from a week in Havana, Cuba, where among the things I did was take a tour of a model city of Havana with Miguel Coyula, an architect with the Group for the Integral Development of the City of Havana, as we continue that journey through Cuba's capital. You mentioned this building that you clearly abhor, the Spanish-Cuban joint venture,
yes,
which is a hotel.
Yes.
What about some of the other joint ventures? Who's coming in to Havana as the U.S. corporations look on and drool?
Well, something, for example, very, very interesting is that Israelis are investing in Cuba. So we have here in the district of Miramar, a Cuban-Israeli company is building a new business center. So that tells you that politics and business can go apart.
And yet, doesn't Israel usually support the U.S. embargo at the United Nations?
Precisely. When they vote in the United Nations, the last voting was 147 votes against the embargo and 3 votes supporting the embargo was United States, Israel, and Uzbekistan. But it's surprising that the Israelis vote against the embargo in the United Nations, but they invest money here in building a new trade center in Havana.
And that's going forward?
Yeah, it's going forward. Now they started the Earth Movement now.
Maybe they're very smart. Maybe they don't want the U.S. competition.
Maybe they want to be... I think that many foreign investors, they want to be here before the embargo is lifted. They know that once the embargo will be lifted, many small developers could not resist the competition of the big American companies.
You also point out that there are some who develop their architecture without ever being here, which causes a big problem.
Yes. We have the case of the former Soviet embassy, now the Russian embassy, that the architect never visited Havana. So now there is a big complex that doesn't fit in Miramar because there is a big tower there, and it's not the best example of architecture. So those things should not be repeated anymore.
You told a funny joke earlier about the best place to see the city.
Yes, I was telling the visitors that could be the best place to see the city because when you stand at the top of the tower, you don't see it.
What about the country clubs and the wealthy areas that used to be occupied by the wealthy before the revolution? What are they occupied by now?
Well, the former exclusive clubs, like the Havana Yacht and Country Club.
It's actually called that in Spanish or English?
Its name was in English, always. They never used Spanish. They like it to speak in English and to name their things in English. So the Havana Yacht and Country Club was so exclusive that they never allowed President Batista to be a member because he wasn't purely white. And that's why Batista invested 2 million pesos building a new club, the Biltmore Yacht and Country Club, also in English the name, to be the president of that club, to be admitted. But now those clubs are administrated by labor unions. So labor unions administrate these clubs for the workers.
You also showed us some interesting contrasts. For example, the Jesuit school where Fidel Castro was raised.
Yes.
Next to?
It's next to the biggest or the most famous nightclub in Cuba, Tropicana. It's known in the world. So I was joking about that virtue and sin can be together in the city. And maybe the Tropicana was there to test the loyalty to their faith, to her faith.
What about that Jesuit school? What is it today?
Today is a military school. It's a military university.
What about the large churches in Havana? I mean, this is going to be a big discussion when the Pope comes to Havana, is the role of the Catholic Church, the fact that the state declared itself atheist.
Something has changed, something that maybe there is, for me, is a dramatic change that took place in 1992 that hasn't been publicized adequately, is that there was a reform in our Constitution. The reform consists in declaring that there are many kinds of property. There is a social property, collective property, and private property. So that recognizes, the Constitution now recognizes that there are different kinds of property. And the second important change is that Cuba has no official philosophy. It means that all the religions were declared equal. They have the same right to exist in our conditions. It's true that the Catholic religion is the strongest religion in Cuba, but the strongest in terms of organization. But I can tell you that in Cuba we have a very deep root in Afro-Cuban religion. If you visit the popular neighborhoods, you will find that every person has an altar dedicated to the divinities of the Afro-Cuban religion. Afro-Cuban religion is a mix of Catholic religion and the African roots because the slaves were brought naked. So they only brought in their minds the ideas of the principles of their tradition. So they had to transmit orally the basis of the rules of their religion. But on the other hand, they were forced to adopt the Catholic religion by their owners, by their masters. And they had to find a compromise between the roots, their African roots, and the imposition of their white masters. So they created what we call the syncretism, is a mix of the African divinities and the Catholic divinities. And for example, we have that Saint Barbara is Chango in the Yoruba religion, or we have that Yemaya is the Virgin of Regla, and the Virgin of the Charity is Ochun. And they are dressed the way the slaves, the domestic slaves, were dressed. So there is a combination. But the songs, the rituals are preserved. And if we look carefully to these Afro-Cuban religions, we will see that they are more related to the land. I mean, they are related to the environment, to the animals, to the trees. They don't have a specific hour for a mass, but they have specific celebrations. When they have, for example, the 4th of December is the St. Barbara's Day, so they celebrate it with playing the drums and singing songs and initiating people in their religion. But the doors of these Santeria priest houses are open every day of the week at every time. And instead of telling you that you should pray, that you should repent and so on, they try to find a solution for your problem. So every time you go to see a Santeria priest, they try to analyze your problem and to give you a solution. So that's why this religion is so strong. And many people go to the Catholic Church and later go to the Santeria priest.
And there are large Catholic churches here in Havana.
Some of them are very beautiful, like the cathedral, of course. The cathedral of Havana is one of the most, or maybe the beautiest building in the city. It's a Baroque building, very beautiful, that was the tomb of Christopher Columbus until he was transferred. Was transferred to the Dominican Republic. And he was buried there until 1899.
Where will the Pope be in Havana, do you know?
He will have a big mass in the Square of the Revolution. They are now preparing the altar. He will have. He will visit many places. He will visit San Lazarus Church in the outskirts of the city. And he will visit many places out of the city, Santiago de Cuba, Camagüey, Pinar del Río, Santa Clara. So he will have a very active schedule.
It's actually a little unlike the Catholic Church was before the revolution, because they mainly focused here, didn't they?
Yes. The Catholic Church in Cuba wasn't so strong because they didn't have the autochthonous personnel. So many...
The what?
The personnel, the people, the priests were not Cuban. They didn't have enough Cuban people to be the priests of in every church. So many Spanish priests were working here in Cuba, and many of them were Orthodox and were Franco supporters. So that's why there was a they never supported the ideas of the revolution. Most of them served the upper classes. That's why the Catholic religion, the Catholic Church, not the religion, the Catholic Church wasn't so popular. But now the new church is more adapted to the new conditions, and they recognize the social changes, and they recognize the role of the church in nowadays conditions.
Just three other quick questions. One is about the Bay of Havana, which is to the east of the old city. If you look beyond, there's this constant torch, which is actually just behind the Christ of Havana, uh-huh, which has to do with the oil industry. Can you talk about what oil companies have been here?
Yes, oil business was controlled by foreign companies, 100%. Three big companies were dealing with this. There was a Shell Oil, Esso Standard Oil, and Texaco. And a small company, Sinclair Oil, was also importing gasoline, not refining. So there were two big refineries here, the Esso Standard Oil and the Shell Oil. And Texaco had a refinery in Santiago de Cuba. So after the revolution, these refineries were nationalized and turned into a big refinery here.
And there they burn off the oil?
Yes, because of the embargo, there was a big lack of spare parts, and the technology has been preserved by the workers, inventing and innovating every day something new. But there are many, many things that could astonished, somebody that comes and see, but that technology is from the 50s, but the technology is preserved, and the refineries are still refining oil and preserving it. And that's why you see something you don't see in other places today, is the flare. The flare is a tower that burns the remaining gas, because that gas is not used. But now the government is considering to use that gas in a new power plant with a capacity of 100 megawatts will be built soon, and the plant will burn gas instead of oil.
How polluted was the Bay of Havana when Texaco, Sinclair, Shell, and the others were here?
They started. The pollution started in the 50s with these refineries, but later the pollution became bigger when the ships were supplying oil to the refinery, and the rivers that feed the water, the bay with you, fresh water, became contaminated also. So now the problem is how to clean the bay. And in order to clean the bay, we have the support of the Norwegian government. They sent some consultants, and they are helping us to set a plan for the decontamination of the bay. But now, regarding the oil spills, now the oil is coming through a pipeline from the Bay of Matanzas. The Bay of Matanzas is open and can host supertankers. So now a supertanker can deliver the oil that three regular tankers can deliver to the bay. Because of the long and narrow canal, supertankers can get in. So the supertankers go to Matanzas and they deliver the oil through a pipeline right here. So that reduces the contamination.
Doesn't Matanzas mean massacre?
Massacre. Matanzas is because Indians were massacred when the conquerors came. So our autochthonous population was massacred. Our indigenous population, the Indians, were killed practically. Huh. There was about a half million Indians living in Cuba, and they disappeared very soon.
It's interesting that now at the Bay of Matanzas, that it's oil refineries, it's oil companies, because that so often is where indigenous people clash, but now they aren't here. The other question is about the cemetery, which you were talking about UNESCO making this a World Historic Site. Is the cemetery one of the marked sites?
Well, the cemetery itself hasn't been declared World Heritage, but the cemetery belongs to the landmarks of the city. And this is one of the biggest cemeteries, not only in the city or in Cuba, it's one of the biggest cemeteries in Latin America. And it's one of the most important cemeteries in the Americas, because it covers 65 hectares. And it's a paradox that we have in a poor country a so luxurious cemetery, because it's said that in the cemetery, in the Christopher Columbus Cemetery, you can find more marble from Carrara than in Carrara.
Italy.
In Italy. Yes. It said so. But more or less, the cemetery is a replica of the city. The more luxurious...
Miguel Coyula, an architect from the Group for the Integral Development of the City of Havana, will finish our tour of the city tomorrow. So close and yet so far, just 90 miles off the coast of Florida, yet cut off from the United States by a U.S. embargo almost since the revolution of 1959. We'll also continue our conversations in Cuba throughout this week and the coming weeks leading up to the arrival of the Pope. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!